So I want to welcome everyone to Seder Pearls. This is going to be a quick tour. My section, at least, will be a quick tour through what I hope will be six or seven very short pieces of the Seder. And if you'll indulge me and grant me your forgiveness at the beginning, I'll ask you to hold off on the questions and consider each of these to be topics that are food for thought and can be further pursued at your own leisure. Let me begin with Karpas. Okay. Of the four questions of the Manishtana, there's one question that we never really answer in the Seder, and that is the question of why do we dip twice on Seder night? Okay. Obviously, the answer to all questions on Seder night is to encourage the children to ask questions. That's a very valid answer, but there is another explanation as well. And that is because the entire Exodus story was bookended by two events that involved dipping. Does anyone remember the first event that involved dipping? Karpas was not the first event that involved dipping. The first event that involved dipping, that's the last one. The first one was actually Yosef. The Haggadah wants us to think back all the way back to the Yosef story. It was that moment when the brothers, in their deep hatred, their deep enmity of their brother Yosef, decide not to kill him, but they do the next worst thing and sell him into slavery. They dip his colored coat into blood and bring it back to their father, making him believe that Yosef is in fact deceased. And this is, some form or fashion, the beginning of the Exodus narrative. How did we get to Egypt in the first place? We got to Egypt because Yosef's brothers almost literally sold him down the river. That's the beginning of the process. But the process also ends, the Yitzhak Mitzrayim also ends with the famous dipping, and that's what Robert mentioned, and that is the bundle of hyssop, the Agudas Ezov, that we dip into the blood, that our ancestors dipped into the blood on the eve, on the doorstep of the Exodus, to symbolize that this is a Jewish home, and it would merit the protection of Hashem. And so we begin by noting that the Exodus is bookended by these two important stories. Okay. Let me move to the next piece. I want to jump for a second to Magid. Magid, to the untrained eye, appears like a real hodgepodge of disorganized and haphazardly arranged sources and quotations. And is there any rhyme or reason to the trajectory of the Magid section of the Haggadah? And I want to share with you an explanation by Rav Tzvi Rimon, who writes the following, and I think it's really quite compelling. He says, you'll notice that the Magid section can essentially be broken down into three pieces. The first section is really the kiyum in the Machlokes and the Gemara between Rav and Shmuel. They both agree that maschil beganus umesayim b'shvach, that the trajectory of the Pesach Seder should begin with the story of our denigration and lead us to a place of praise. And they disagree as to whether or not we start with avavim hayinu or mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avusein. But really, the first part of the Magid section, Rav Rimon says, is this section, what he calls the story section. It's a narrative section. We're interested in telling the story of the Exodus of the Jewish people, and we're interested in telling about people who have told this story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's section number one. Section number two is really the core of Magid, and that begins with Arami Obed Avi. That's the section with lots and lots of drushos. We have these psukim, and that's the section we usually don't spend that much time on. We're moving quickly through that section to get to the meal. So that's the second section, and that is the learning section. That's the Talmud Torah piece of the Haggadah. And the third section, the third piece of Magid, you know the third piece of Magid? Very end of Magid, what do? We get to Rabban Gamliel and Pesach Matzin Maror. We start what Rabbi Rimon calls the visualization section of Magid, which is to say, we start pointing to this is the Pesach, this is Matzah, this is Maror, Pesach Al-Shuma, Matzah Al-Shuma, Maror Al-Shuma. And this is the means by which we can visualize in three-dimensional terms what the Tzipor Yetzias Mitzrayim story is all about. In keeping with the notion that's really articulated by the Mishnah and echoed in the Gemara and the Rambam, no two children are going to learn the same way. And of course we talk about the Arba Banim, the four children, but no two children are going to learn the same way. We need to cater the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim to the various kinds of individuals who are at our Pesach Seder. So Rabbi Ramon, I think makes this very beautiful and compelling case that we break it up into three modes of learning. The first mode of learning is a story, and we all know that many children and adults alike are moved by narratives, by stories. That makes the issue at hand easier to relate to. And then there are individuals who like the study. Let's look at the text and analyze the text, and we'll do an exegetical an analysis of what it is that we are that we're engaging. And then there are those who are moved by visual aids. You know, you talk about it in the abstract. That's not my speed. I much prefer to be able to look, feel, touch, taste what it is that we're talking about. So let's pick up the matzah. You're talking about matzah. What's this? Let's talk about it. Hold it in your hand, and eventually go ahead and eat it. And this will help broaden the scope by which the story of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim can be understood. And what he points out is that each section quite beautifully contains a learning component. There's content to the section, and then it ends with some form of shevach or hodah, some means by which we are able to articulate our thanks and appreciation for having made it through to the end. So the first section ends with Baruch Shomer Haftachaso. The second section ends with the most famous Dayenu, and the third section ends with that beautiful paragraph Lefika Hanachnu Chayavim Lohodos Lahalel Lashabeach Lafer Lamem Lader Lebrech Lokabeis. In light of what we've experienced, we now owe a debt of gratitude to Hashem, and let us sing His praises. Okay, let me back up now for a moment to Halach Manya. Halach Manya, there's much to say about Halach Manya. I just want to share one brief word, and that is, we all know, this is a famous question, we all know that it's actually a little absurd. Halach Manya, both practically and halachically, you're sitting down to the Seder, you're not really in a position to be inviting people to your Seder at this moment. I say practically because it's 8:30, everyone just said, anyone who needs a Seder took care of their arrangements 3 weeks ago, and they're not taking care of it on Seder night at 8:30 p.m. And halachically, we know that for someone to be part of the consumption of a Korban Pesach, they need to be counted in the Chabura. And that requires minui, that requires some kind of designation ahead of time. You can't plan this last minute, you can't be planned haphazardly. You need to go in as part of a group. So why are we saying halach manya when in fact it doesn't seem to be true? Kol dichbin yesu v'yechol, whoever wants to come and eat, let them come and eat. It rings hollow. It's not really true. So I want to make an argument, and there's much more to say about this for anyone who walked in late. I just mentioned at the beginning, I'm racing through to point out some highlights and headlines that I hope will be food for future thought. And that is, I think there's an argument to be made that a prerequisite for Geula in the Torah is recognition that we are descendants of Avraham Avinu. And it's only to the extent that we embrace his ethics and his mitzvahs, particularly the ethic of chesed, that we will merit geula. When Hashem promises that he's going to be a great nation, inherit the land of Israel, he asks one question. He says, "B'ma'ida," and all of the commentators said, well, it's not in keeping with Abraham's character for Abraham to question God. He says, with what will I know? How will I know that I'll be redeemed? Abraham is the paradigmatic man of faith. In the Torah, what does it mean for him to question? The commentator's answer, his question is not about him, his question is about future generations. I know that I'll remain loyal to you, Hashem, but I can't guarantee that my great-grandchildren will. In what merit will they be redeemed? And part of the answer to that question is, of course, it's in Abraham's merit, but it's to the extent that your grandchildren, Abraham, keep your ethics, keep your values, keep your mitzvos, that they will be redeemed. You'll notice, and we talked about this in our Women of the Bible this past week, the 19th chapter of Sefer Bereishis tells us about the destruction of Sodom. And there's a fascinating comment by Rashi, which is based on the Medrash, because the Torah tells us that when the Malachim came, when the two messengers came to destroy Lot and to destroy Sodom and save Lot, Lot offered them hospitality, and what did he feed them? Anyone remember?
Matzah.
It says he also gave them to drink. So Rashi on the spot. Is it two-word Rashi? Anyone remember the two-word Rashi? He explains why he was giving, why Lot was dispensing matzah. He says two words, Pesachaya. He says it was Pesach. Okay, so without getting into the theological issues behind what it would mean for someone to keep Pesach before the giving of the Torah and before the Exodus itself, I just want to expand and amplify this this one point. You'll notice, again, this is for a longer discussion, you'll notice the multiple layers of connection between the Lot and Sodom story and the Exodus story. There are literary connections, there are thematic connections, but of course you notice that it's a story of basically total destruction with just a few people being being saved, and that is the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Again, you look at the text on a different occasion. We'll look at all the specific parallels and details. But I bring this up again because I want to argue that Hachnasas Orchim, specifically a fealty to Abraham's Hachnasas Orchim. Again, this is Lot, the nephew of Abraham, who grew up in the home of Abraham and who obviously learned these characteristics. Lot models the Hachnasas Orchim that he learned from Abraham, and that becomes, right, who needs that whole piece of chapter 19? Just say the Malachim came and they saved Lot. But we get the sense right at the beginning that a prerequisite for Geula, a prerequisite for being redeemed, for being saved, is a fealty to this ethic of Abraham Avinu. When you get to the doorstep of Egypt, we know that the Jewish people are busy performing the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. There's much to say about Korban Pesach, but I'll just share with you an insight of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, one of my favorites on the topic. He says, you know, in most other civilizations, in most other societies, it's the have-nots who are dependent on the haves. So I don't have any money. You do. I come to you. You have a factory. I need a job. I come to you. This is the very first mitzvah. Chodesh HaZalachem, we always think of as first mitzvah. It's actually the prerequisite for the first mitzvah, which we perform as a nation, which is Korban Pesach. So it's Korban Pesach, the very foundation of mitzvah observance, he says, flips this paradigm on its head. Sela Beis Avos, Sela Bayis means that every family needs to polish off an entire Korban Pesach. So now the tables are turned. So I have, I'm the one who has. I have means, I have resources, so I'm able to buy a sheep, I'm able to buy a lamb. But I can't perform the mitzvah unless I invite you to my house. Because there's no way, as many lamb chops as I could possibly eat, there's no way I can polish off an entire Korban Pesach myself. I need your help. So it's not the have-nots who are dependent on the haves, but quite the opposite. Sela Beis Avos, Sela Bayis requires that we will remain loyal to the ethic of Hachnasas Orchim, and that of course becomes the prerequisite. It's only those who participate in Korban Pesach who merit redemption. And that brings us back to Harachmanya, how beautiful that we begin our Seder with that self same declaration. Kol Dich Bin Yesev Yechol. It may not have pragmatic value at this moment, but we are expressing in no uncertain terms that we are loyal to this very same ethic. We want, in principle, to be able to invite everyone to our Seder table and to invite everyone into our home. Okay, let me jump ahead now to the Rasha. One brief, very brief thought on the Rasha, and that is to answer the question of why we're so hard on the Rasha. What makes him so dastardly that we can't even have a conversation with him, that we knock out his teeth. One possibility is a suggestion by Rav Mordechai Rubinstein, who says that what's the objection? The Haggadah itself tells us what did the Rasha do wrong? He was, but says atzmo, right? That he removed atzmo himself from the community. Rav Mordechai Rubinstein says that atzmo in the Gemara is sometimes a euphemism for God. There are a number of proof texts for this that we won't get into to right now. The most famous is the case of Titus, who the Gemara says was if he pierced atzmo, right? It was a euphemism for God. It's possible to answer the question of why we're so harsh on the Rasha, why we're so rough on him, because unlike the Chacham, he's removed not himself from the equation, but he's removed God from the equation. And he's at the Seder table, and we know people like this. Maybe they'll go through the motions. Maybe they'll join us. But if you take God out of the equation, that is deeply problematic, and obviously it needs to be addressed. I am just about out of time, but I want to conclude with one final thought before I turn things over to Rabbi Fridman for the next section. And that is, Rav Soloveitchik once pointed out that one of the fascinating phenomena that we notice when it comes to the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, when it comes to the Exodus story, is that typically speaking, when it comes to revolts and rebellions and revolutions, there's an impetus or a desire on the part of the victim to take vengeance, right? When the tables are turned and now the victim has the upper hand, so now I really want to give it to my tormentor, my captor, and I want them to feel what it's like to be on the other side. And that sentiment is entirely and so conspicuously absent from the entire Exodus narrative. We never do that. It was so silent, the Torah says, you could even hear the dark barking of a dog. That's how quiet it was. We were in our homes, we were silent, we were performing our mitzvot with no interest and no intent on this notion of vengeance. And in fact, the Yerushalmi actually says that on the way out of Egypt, or even before our way out of Egypt, the very first mitzvah that Moshe gave to the Jewish people was a command to free their own slaves. To the extent that the Jewish people had their own slaves, Moshe said, it's time to let them go. Why? Because psychologically, and I know there are some psychologists in the room, so correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a common phenomenon for the abused to become the abuser. So right up front, Moshe says, based on this Yerushalmi, Moshe tells the Jewish people, I don't want that to happen. We're going to have none of that. Right away, I want you to know, the moment you become free is not the moment that you turn around and use your freedom to do something violent or do something cruel to anyone else. That's exactly not what we're after, and we go out of our way to demonstrate that. I mentioned that just in the context of the Haggadah, based on a comment of the Meshech Chachma, I can't prove it, but I think it's worth thinking about. We all know that the Medrash says, I mentioned this on Shabbos, the Medrash says that there were four particular areas in which the Jewish people remained committed to the Masorah in Egypt, and it was in the merit of those four mitzvos that they were redeemed. And there are a number of different texts as to what exactly those four mitzvos were. One of them is Lashon Hara, that the Jews in Egypt were careful not to be guilty of character assassination. Right? They could have had a lot of things to say about the Egyptians, but they never did. And I bring this up just in a general way to close this section, because I think it's noteworthy that we mention the cruelty of the Egyptians in the Haggadah really only in a passing way, and really only as a way by which to measure and appreciate the salvation brought about by Hashem. To appreciate our salvation, we obviously need to understand the depth of our suffering. But we don't bring up the suffering at the hands of the Egyptians in the context of saying, look how terrible those people were. By and large, and I think it's really worth thinking about, by and large, the Haggadah is not interested in Lashon Hara, and quite the opposite. It wants to protect us from falling into this trap. It would be so easy to go down this path, and just in the course of telling the story of the Exodus and the story of the salvation of the Jewish people, to just pause for however long people pause at the Seder to say, you know, those no good, rotten Egyptians, you know, they did that, and we stop ourselves. That's not our goal. We need to say something about the Egyptians to appreciate the salvation, but we have much higher and much more ambitious expectations for what it is that we are trying to accomplish on Seder night. Perhaps we are in fact echoing the very stance of the Jewish people in Egypt. And just as they were redeemed in the merit of their keeping from telling Lashon Hara, we remain loyal to that self-same ethic at the Seder, and do our utmost to avoid falling into that trap. On that note, I want to turn things over to our resident scholar, Rabbi Daniel Fridman, for the next section. And I wish everyone in advance a Chag Kasher B'Sameach.
כך של הרבים.
Every year I'm always very touched at the hullabaloo of pre-Pesach that people manage to find time to come out to learn. So it's really very, very nice. So anybody here know who Jeff Van Gundy is? Yeah, yeah, exactly. So Jeff Van Gundy, after he was he resigned as the coach of the Knicks, so he became the coach of the Rockets. After he was actually a commentator for a few years before then, and after he was fired from being the coach of the Rockets, he became a commentator again. So one of the things that he was involved in as a coach, this wasn't his primary responsibility, but it was one of his responsibilities, was to be involved in the selection of players in the NBA draft. So there are all kinds of things that you want to evaluate in that context. You want to evaluate players' height and their athleticism, how high they jump, and what you think that their potential upside is as a basketball player. You probably also want to evaluate issues like character and work ethic, like people applying for any job. But Van Gundy said once, it was in the context of an NBA draft, he said that the most important thing from his point of view, and sometimes the most overlooked thing, was, does this person love to play basketball? Does this person love to play basketball? So why does that matter? A person could be very good at basketball without really loving to play basketball, but on the elite level, right, where you're dealing with a very, very high level of natural, right, so if you have great natural ability and you're playing against people who are mediocre, actually doesn't matter how much you love to play basketball, but on the elite level of any practice or discipline, intellectual or athletic in this case, right, what really makes a difference is the love of it, because that ultimately will propel somebody to work at it that much harder and to distinguish themselves amongst elite competition. I think this is very important, and I think that in general, how much somebody likes something and how much they really love it, not always the case, but it's very often the case that it correlates with their ultimate success in that. And in as much as this is true, religion has a fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem of any religious system, it's not only a Jewish problem, but it certainly applies to Judaism, is that given the fact that we're all essentially bound to do this, right, so then the question of how much we love it, it becomes a vulnerability, right? Because if you're trying to raise, let's just pick four kids, because it's Pesach time, right? So what are the chances that all four of your kids are going to love Judaism, right? If you're honest, right? Very small. What are the chances that one of your kids will love Judaism? The system of restrictions, the system of all kinds of demands that make some people it's much harder in certain respects than a Western lifestyle, right? So you have a problem, right? People don't love it, so how well are they really going to do it? And the answer is, with a tremendous amount of mediocrity, often. So how does religion, or how does Judaism try to answer that question? It's a basic problem that any coercive system has, is that it cannot be self-selected. So again, if it's the NBA, right, and nobody puts a gun to your head and says, you must play in the NBA, the chances are the play will pretty much be on a high level because nobody's got a gun to their head and forced into it. Self-selecting systems always have that advantage. Now, self-selecting systems also have a disadvantage, which is that, once a person is no longer interested, so they can leave it, right? You don't build that kind of fidelity through adversity that a coercive system that's mother's milk can have. But let's leave that for another time. So what is Judaism's answer to this question? So I would like to try to argue that basically that's what the Pesach Seder is about. There are many different parts of the Pesach Seder. We just heard about a lot of them. But I think that it's basically a night that's devoted on the Jewish calendar to try to answer this question. It's a fundamental problem for which we don't have an entirely suitable answer, but in as much as we are a coercive system, right, we consider it to be normatively obligated of us to be Jewish, to practice Judaism, nonetheless, we're still deeply concerned that people should love it, and people should grow to love it. And it's not just by bribing people, with happy events on occasion, because that will never get them to embrace the system in its totality. Right? You could say, oh, well, focus on the parts of it that you like, but that really wouldn't be doing the system. That would just be picking and choosing the parts of the system that you like. So then what is our approach? Okay. Any suggestions? How would we begin to approach that question? Assuming that we value, right, actually feeling attached to something.
Training.
Okay, so one is over, Ellie?
Getting the kids involved,
Okay, but let's say the kid says, I'm not interested.
Stimulation.
What's that?
Stimulation.
Right, so you could stimulate people in a short-term kind of way, but if they, I mean, how are you going to sustain this? What's that? The candy, right. So candy is, right, so there are, actually Michael is I think more accurate than not, right? There are juvenile forms of candy and there are adult forms of candy, but that's essentially the approach that many systems try to take. We'll offer a lot of food, we'll make a really good kiddish, right? But you can't really sustain any fundamental interest in the system under those conditions. So what then is a way of doing it?
Money.
What's that? Well, money is a more sophisticated form of candy. You could call money adult candy. And as the Rambam himself notes in the Marne Vuchem, actually an even more adult form of candy than money is prestige. You don't offer people a lot of honor. Right? They're all different kinds of ways of abstracting and making more sophisticated the form of bribe that you're offering, but you're never actually getting people involved in the system on its own terms. So I think that intellectually what you really have to do, and again, be interested in hearing all of your thoughts about this, but I only have about like 7 minutes, so I'll say it very quickly. I think intellectually what you have to try to do is you have to try to offer people, well, what would the alternative have been? And to me, that is the phrase that everybody here is very familiar with, the heart of the Pesach Seder, Chayav Adam Liras Asatzmo Ki'ilu Hu Yatza Mi Mitzrayim. Not just because somehow this will make us more grateful, but actually what you're really doing by putting yourself back at that very moment is saying, okay, well, to really appreciate what it is that I have now and why ultimately I should really embrace the system, why I might even say you should really love the system, is to look at what the alternative was, to go back to a time when you remembered what I would call a non-covenantal experience, an experience before Judaism was really thrust upon you in the fullest sense of the term. So what is a non-covenantal experience? What was the experience of our forefathers in Egypt? So you could say, well, it's kind of cheating to pick such a low moment, but the thing is, I don't really think it's cheating at all. What are the basic laws of history? Well, there's before God intervened and turned nature on its head and towards history on its head and brought us close to Him. What is existence in the non-covenantal sense of the term? Right? As if you say, well, okay, I wish that there were no Judaism. I wish that I didn't have this burden upon me. So you say, okay, fine, so let's explore what that would be together. What is an existence without God? So the basic laws of history essentially dictate that you have mighty and you have weak, and you could hope to be born into the mighty, but the chances are that you'll be born into the weak. There are more losers than winners in the game of history, right? So everybody here, right, or at least many of the people here, were born into, you know, the West, this essentially very wealthy society, right? Different people have different levels of wealth and different kinds of challenges, right? But if you're not one of the very 300 million people born in the United States or other countries in Western Europe, if you're born into Sub-Saharan Africa or Asia or someplace like that, and, you know, your big challenge is to have running water, clean running water, you might not feel so good about the laws of history. So the non-covenantal experience is filled with a tremendous amount of suffering. Avadim Hayinu L'Paro B'Mitzrayim isn't such an exception to that rule. I actually think it's more the norm than you would imagine. And the covenantal experience, even though it's had its ups and downs, gives a direction to history. But I think there are these two other dimensions that we try to highlight as we answer this question. Let me take one source and just put it on the table and try to explain it in this context. The Michilta notes that one has to ask questions on Pesach night, even if there's nobody there, so you ask questions of yourself. And the question is, like, what does that even mean, to ask questions of yourself that you know the answers to? Is that a meaningful religious experience? What does it mean that you have to ask yourself questions? I think it's exactly this point, that you have to ask yourself the fundamental question, and you're not really having a Pesach Seder unless you're deeply asking a searching existential question. And we try to educate ourselves and we try to educate our children about this point. What is the transition between the non-covenantal experience and the covenantal experience? Why should we love Judaism even though it is being imposed upon us? How can we actually develop a real investment to the system? I think it's only by comparing it with what life could have and would have been like without it. So let me introduce two incredible benefits that come with the covenantal system that I think the Seder tries to get us to think about. What is non-covenantal man's relationship with time? What is his relationship with the past? What is his relationship with the future? So again, a person who is not involved in any deep covenant he can't really have any interest in the past per se. All he could have is a very superficial level of interest and say, well, either the past interests me in some very superficial intellectual way, I'm kind of curious about history, but purely in an intellectual sense, or most people who don't like history, and many people in this room like history, I happen to like history, but unless you fall into that category, it could be a very narcissistic approach to the past. Like, I'm grateful to Jonas Salk for inventing the polio vaccine. I'm grateful to Alexander Fleming for being involved in the discovery of penicillin, but I have no deep relationship with the past. It's not alive for me. And what's my relationship with the future? My relationship to the future is essentially, well, I hope that I'm remembered for something good. That there's no deep relationship, deep investment in the future, qua the future, that the future is somehow meaningful, because there's no covenant. So what consequence is the future if life is really about nothing more than the here and now? This, I think, was articulated very accurately by the existentialists. Camus and Sartre spoke about this point, about the incapacity of man to relate to anything in any meaningful way besides the present. I think non-covenantal man is trapped by the present. Covenantal man, on the other hand, which is really what the Seder is all about, can have an exceptionally meaningful relationship with the past and with the future. He can be invested in a way that non-covenantal man could never be. And that is an incredible perk. I use that term, obviously, somewhat crass term. I think that's an incredible benefit of being involved in a covenantal experience. It's something to truly love about what it is that we have, that we could be involved in the past not just as an intellectual curiosity, or saying what we got from the past and being grateful for it, but seeing the past as somehow deeply related to our own experience, and seeing the future, in other words, the trajectory of the covenant, as somehow deeply relevant to what it is that we want here in this world. Non-covenantal man has no relationship with the past or future. Only covenantal man could have that, in any real sense. Point number one. Point number two is that the experience of the covenant, really going through Yetzias Mitzrayim, hopefully inspires in us a great sense of meaning, the ultimate meaning in life. How does non-covenantal man derive meaning? In one of two ways, both, in my view, somewhat superficial. One is the principle of hedone, or pleasure, right? You could try to pursue things that you find pleasurable, hopefully not at other people's expense, but even if it amounts to that sometimes, that's one way of deriving meaning. The other way of deriving meaning is by getting some kind of approbation, right? Living off compliments, or living off having achieved something in somebody else's eyes. But here's the problem. That works really well if you're talented. Let's say you're very bright. So then you can get a lot of accolades for being very bright. Let's say you're very wealthy. So then people will give you a lot of kavod, either because they want something for you or they're actually impressed by your wealth. But let's say you're, like most people, mediocre. You don't have outstanding abilities in any which way. So then what's life to you, right? You don't fit into that exceptional category. But covenantal man is truly liberated from both the shackles of hedone, as well as the shackles of trying to, gain meaning through other people's approval, because all he's called to do, ironically, all he's called to do is to be the very best version of himself possible. To serve God in some kind of honest and authentic way. And that's exactly what Chazal meant when they said, "Ein ben chorin ela obed l'makom." There is no free person, other person who serves God. What does that mean? I mean that seems like ridiculous, right? If I was a free person, I could go to the movies on Friday night. I wouldn't have a million restrictions. Now that I'm obligated by the Torah, I've got a million laws that I otherwise wouldn't have had. But what they mean by that, ain ben chorin ela makom, is that a person within that context can be free of some kind of an external system of gratification or the approbation of others, and find deep meaning, ultimate meaning, in serving God, where you'll be judged by a purely relative standard. In other words, God will never ask you why you weren't Jonas Salk. He just say, in a deep way, did you do the best job you could with your ability? I think it's basically that point that makes the covenantal experience one that we should not only do, but truly love. I think that's essentially the challenge of Pesach night. It's our religion's way of asking us to ask the question of, can we ever love this system that's been imposed on us? Can we ever really do it with vigor, even though it wasn't our choice? And in light of the fact that what we gain from the experience of covenant is a deep relationship with the past and future that we otherwise never would have had, number one, and number two, were liberated from all of the laws of history that, okay, if you're lucky, you're born into the mighty. You probably aren't so lucky to be born into the mighty. And also, now you can really just be yourself. And if you're mediocre from an objective standpoint, because you're not exceptionally wealthy, you're not exceptionally attractive, and you're not exceptionally gifted in any which way, but your life still is replete with deep meaning, because all you have to do is serve God authentically and honestly. If we can educate ourselves about that on Pesach night, educate our children about that, I think we'll have accomplished what it is the Seder is about.
All right, I have a sources I prepared, so I'll hand them out on both sides and see if you can pass them around. I took one for myself. It's really an incredible kavod to follow both Rabbi Levine and Rabbi Friedman, and it's a kavod as well to precede Rabbi Zirkin. So the mechilas kavod arasam. The first 40 seconds of this are going to be familiar to those who studied with me this past Tuesday night, the first 40 seconds will be somewhat familiar, so they'll recognize the story at the beginning. Several years ago, my father undertook a fascinating project. Anyone who's been to my house in my parents' house in West Hempstead in the last several years may have seen it, because it's somewhat of an eyesore. The base of it is a block of wood that my father hand carved. And on top of this block of wood, my father wanted to build a menorah. And he wanted to pay tribute to the verse in Yeshaya, the Chetucha Rasam Leitim, the Chanino Sehem Lamaz Neros, and beat your swords into plowshares and your spears into pruning hooks. So what he attempted to do was to take an implement of war, a weapon, and turn it into a celebration of peace, of the end of war, of Hanukkah. So what he did was he wanted to build a menorah on this block of wood out of 9 anti-aircraft shells from World War II. 8 would serve as the candles, and 1 would serve as the shamash. So now, let me ask you, if you want to get 9 World War II era anti-aircraft shells, who do you call? Where do you go? What do you do? The answer is obvious. You call Colonel Bubba's military supply in Galveston, Texas, obviously. It's the largest, I kid you not, you can Google it, it's the largest military supplier in the United States. You call Colonel Bubba. So my father calls up Colonel Bubba. Luckily, he did some business back in the day in Texas. So he goes down to, he calls up Colonel Bubba and says, I have somewhat of a strange request. I am constructing a candelabra for the holiday of Hanukkah, and I would like to procure from you 9 World War II era anti-aircraft shells. And Colonel Bubba responds to him, no problem, I'll take care of it. So he goes down to Galveston, Texas. He's in Houston for some business, so he hops over to Galveston because he wanted to meet Colonel Bubba. Those of you who knew my father, some of you in the Jewish Center who've been here for some time, will know that even as a child, he was somewhat obsessive-compulsive about military supply. So he walks into this enormous warehouse, which is full of tanks and airplanes and bombers and, you know, all grenades, all sorts of things that if they could have fit into his drawers when he was a kid, he would have had them in there. And he was dead set on meeting this Colonel Bubba, who had supplied him with the anti-aircraft shells that he needed to construct his menorah. So he gets back into the back of the warehouse, and he walks into Colonel Bubba's office, and there he sees the man who was exactly the way that any of us could have pictured him. He's this grizzled old Marine veteran, former Marine, with a crew cut, wearing fatigues, barrel-chested, big handlebar mustaches, chomping on a cigar. And my father walks in, and he says, Colonel Bubba, it's nice to meet you. My name is Shalom Lamb. I ordered those anti-aircraft shells from you several months ago to build a menorah, to build, you know, a candelabra for Hanukkah. And he looks at my father. He takes a cigar out of his mouth. He blows out his handlebar mustaches. He looks my father dead in the eye, and he says, "Du bist der Yid." My father almost fainted, and I'll never forget when he told me that story. And the moral of the story, if there is one, I think there are several, but one moral of the story is that, of course, Jews come in all shapes and sizes, and nowhere is this more apparent than on the night of Pesach. What do I mean? The text that dominates the ritual that dominates the modern, and by modern I mean for the last several millennia, the modern experience of within Judaism that is modern. The night of Pesach is the reading of the Haggadahs, the recitation of the Maggid, and the procession through the Seder, the reading of the Haggadah. We imagine the Haggadah as a text that is essentially frozen in time, in stasis, if you will. It's something that has essentially been unaltered from time immemorial, and it's just been passed down from generation to generation. And this is, of course, to a very large extent, true. What we often fail to recognize nowadays, however, that the Haggadah text has entirely been standardized with one or two minor variants across the spectrum of Ashkenazim and Sephardim and all of the different Edot, is that for several hundred years, really almost 1,000 years, there were essentially two texts of the Haggadah that were wildly disparate. In many ways they were similar, but in many other important ways they were wildly disparate. And these are, so on the one hand we have the Babylonian text of the Haggadah, which is the text that we use. It is a text that we know, thanks to the careful records of the Babylonian Gaonim, of the Rambam, of the Talmidim of Rashi, and subsequent Rishonim and authorities, as well as several dozen fragments from the Cairo Geniza, we know was essentially standardized by about the 9th century, relatively early on, and it represents the version of the Haggadah that we use nowadays. It's an expansive version of the Haggadah. Maggid, as all of our kids know, is long, and takes a long time, and it takes quite some time to get to Shulchan Aruch. That's the Babylonian tradition, the Babylonian Nusach of the Haggadah, and it relies primarily on the Piskei Halacha of the Talmud Bavli and the interpretations of the Mishnah that are found within the Babylonian Talmud, redacted in about the 6th century of the Common Era in Persian Babylonia. On the other hand, we have the Eretz Yisrael version of the Haggadah, and it's several versions. It's really, it was never ever standardized because it lost to the Babylonian version of the Haggadah relatively early on in its existence. But in dozens upon dozens of fragments and complete manuscripts that we have, both from the Cairo Geniza as well as from other epigraphical sources that have been published over the course of the last 100 years, discovered and published over the course of the last 100 years, we know that there was another version of the Haggadah, which was based in large part on the Piskei Halacha of the Talmud Yerushalmi, as well as the customs, broadly speaking, that we have for which we have evidence of the Jews and the Chachamim of the land of Israel. This text was incredibly popular, and in certain areas of the world was dominant until eventually, due to the successful efforts of the Gaonim, and eventually of the Chachamim of Babel, it was abandoned in favor of the Babylonian Nusach slowly over the course of several hundred years, in favor of the Babylonian Nusach that we use nowadays. Now, the first source in your source sheets will also be familiar to those who came Tuesday night, but we're going to focus on a completely different part of the Manishtana. What I'd like to do is compare the two textual versions of the Haggadah for which we have evidence, our Haggadah, the Babylonian Haggadah, as well as the Eretz Yisrael Haggadahs, with the text of the Mishnah in Pesachim that records the different components of the Manishtana question. In the Mishnah, upon which all of our Haggadahs are based in their embryonic form, the Mishnah in Pesachim records three components of the Manishtana question. The last component of the question is Shabachol Halelos Anu Ochalim Batzar Tzali Shaluk Mvushal Halayla Azeh Kulot Tzali. On all other nights, it's the same format as the rest of the Manishtana. On all other nights, we eat meat of all different sorts of variety: cooked meat, roasted meat, barbecued meat, bratwurst. The Achronim, we talk about this text, mention hot dogs. I think the Rama mentions sausages. We eat all other sorts of meats. However, tonight, on the night of Pesach, we consume only roasted meat. In other words, meat roasted as the Korban Pesach was supposed to be roasted. Now, skipping over the version of the Manishtana to be found in the Eretz Yisrael Haggadahs, and we'll come back to that in a moment, if you go over to the third column, the Babylonian Haggadah, both Ashkenazic and Sephardic versions of the text, you'll notice that this question is, in fact, nowhere to be found. Does anyone know why this question is nowhere to be found? Can anyone guess, perhaps? What is this question talking about? When was this question, to what time period would this question have been relevant? After the destruction of the temple? Well, before the destruction of the temple, right. Right, I believe the, right, exactly. The Mishnah would be referring to the state of affairs during the era of the temple when we slaughtered the Korban Pesach. However, the Haggadah that we use nowadays is relevant to the time period after the destruction of the temple, and therefore that question is no longer no longer pertinent to the authentic experience of the Haggadah. And in fact, this is the way that the Bavli interpreted this question, or this component of the Manashana question, is evident from source number 2 on your source sheets. The Bavli says, Halayla azeh kulot saliv, Amar Rav Chizda, the third generation Amora, lived in the third century in the city of Sura, somewhere in northern Iraq, near Fallujah, actually. What he said is that Zod Divrei Ben Tema, that this question accords with the view of Ben Tema. The view of Ben Tema, as the Bavli goes on to explain, deals with the manner in which one is supposed to bring the Karban Chagiga of the 14th day of Nisan that accompanies this Karban Pesach. In other words, the way that Rav Chisda understood this question is that it was teaching us something about the protocol, the sacrificial protocols during the era when the temple still stood and sacrifices were still being brought. And hence, this question is omitted from our Haggadah. And when we say the Manishtana, we omit this question entirely and we substitute in its place two other questions. How those developed is actually an interesting question, but a question for a different time. Now, there is in fact another way of interpreting this Haggadah. It's readily apparent from the fact that the Eretz Yisrael Haggadahs retained this question for centuries after the temple was destroyed, for almost a millennium after the temple was destroyed. And several commentators in Yerushalmi as well as elsewhere understand that this is what the question is referring to as well. Another manner in which we can interpret this question is actually the question in the Mishnah, on all other nights we eat all sorts of meat, prepared in all sorts of different ways, but tonight we eat meat that is roasted, is actually referring to a practice that was popular, but contested during the time of the early generations of Chazal in the period of Yavne, just after the destruction of the temple, and that is the question of whether or not one is allowed to eat a Gedi Mikulas on the night of Pesach. A Gedi Mikulas, however the term is generated, and this is machlokas amongst the later commentators, a dispute amongst the later commentators, a Gedi Mikulas essentially is, as the Tosefta defines it, is a lamb that is roasted, rosho kra v'kirbo, it's roasted the way that a sacrificial lamb, a paschal lamb, was meant to be prepared on the night of Pesach. And what it is essentially an imitation Karban Pesach. There was a practice that people had, several of the Tanayim had, that on Pesach night, on the night of Pesach, they would bring a Gedi Mikulas. They would bring an imitation Pesach. Why? For whatever reason. They wanted to, we'll explore that in a moment, but they wanted to remember what it was like in the days of yore when we had the temple and we could bring a Karban Pesach and all of the joy that accompanied that process. Now, is one allowed to do such a thing? Is one allowed to bring a Gedi Mikulas, an imitation Karban Pesach, on the night of Pesach? Is one allowed to do that? So the answer seems to be, if we look at the first text that seems to mention this, the answer is that under certain circumstances, it's of course permitted. The Mishnah in Pesachim, which is source number 3, is the Mishnah in the fourth parak of Pesachim, says, Makom shenagu lechol tzali b'leil Pesachim ochlin, makom shenagu shelo lechol tzli ein ochlin. So superficially, at first glance, what this text seems to mean is it seems to refer to this practice. If a person wants to eat roasted meat, in other words, we only have roasted meat you'd be eating on Pesach night, and that we have evidence for people eating on Pesach night, is a roasted lamb. So if you have the custom to eat an imitation from Pesach on Pesach night, you may do so. And if you don't, then you may not. In other words, follow the custom of your forefathers. Now, the problem is that we have another explicit source in the Mishnah that seems to contradict that particular understanding of the Mishnah. It may contradict it. And that is source number 4. Source number 4 says, Afu, and this is referring to Rabban Gamliel II of Yavne, who was one of the leading Tanaim of the first generation immediately after the Churban HaBayis in the year 70 CE. So this is a Tana who lived about between the years 70 and 100 CE, let's say, in the first century. So Afu Omer Shlosha Dvar Mohakel. In three ways, or at least in three ways, Rabban Gamliel was more makil than his compatriots amongst the rabbinic movement. In three ways, he ruled more leniently than Mechachamim. And the third of these three ways is Osin Gedi Mikulas B'Leil Pesachim, Mechachamim Osrim. Rabban Gamliel had the practice, and this is Rabban Gamliel, not Rabban Gamliel Hazake, not the elder Rabban Gamliel who lived during the days of the temple. This is the Rabban Gamliel who lived just at the end of and after the destruction of the temple. He had the practice that on Pesach night he would bring a Gedi Mikulas. He would bring an imitation Karban Pesach on the night of Pesach, sort of in memory of what was done in temple times. But the Chachamim thought that this was prohibited. Now, why would this be prohibited? What's the harm in doing something? Seems so innocuous. Just we miss the Korban Pesach so much, and we want to recall the wonderful feeling that we all experienced when we brought this Korban Pesach in the Mikdash. So what's the problem? Why is this a bad thing? So the Tosefta explains, source number 5, the Tosefta says, Amar Rabbi Yossi, Todos Ish Romi, the Udas of Rome. It's interesting from an archaeological perspective. There seems to be, it's possible, I think it's actually likely, there seems to be an actual archaeological record of this Theodos of Rome having lived. He dedicated a synagogue in Yerushalayim for people who wanted to come from the diaspora and stay in Yerushalayim during the Shel Shargalim. Neither here nor there. It's interesting, but in any event, this is a person who lived in Rome, Theudas of Rome. Hineges b'nei Romi likach t'loim b'leili p'sakna v'osan osan mekulasin. He instructed the Jews of Rome, and as we'll see, there's actually extra Talmudic corroboration that this was in fact the case. He instructed the Jews of Rome to bring a gedima kulas, to bring an imitation Korban Pesach on Pesach night. So what was the reaction of his colleagues, the Chachamim Amrlo? Abu Karov lahachil kachim makotz, mipnei shekona sam psachim. What was the problem? People would refer to this imitation Korban Pesach as a Pesach, as a Korban Pesach. They would say, this that we are eating now is a Korban, it is a Pesach, much like we eat the Korban Pesach in Yerushalayim. And the problem was that there was a concern that if you do this sort of thing, if you practice this, if you adopt this sort of practice, it looks like you are taking food, an item that has been consecrated to the temple, and you're eating it outside of the acceptable zone where you may eat it. You're eating kachim b'chutz. You're taking something that has been consecrated to the temple, and you're eating it outside of the area in which it is permissible to eat it. In this case, outside of Yerushalayim. And because there was a concern that people would think, therefore, that it was permissible to eat temple-consecrated items outside of the precincts in which they are to be eaten, this practice of eating an imitation Korban Pesach on the night of Pesach was forbidden. Okay. Now, so what do the Chachamim of the Bavli do with the Mishnah that seems to say that those who have the minhag to eat an imitation Korban Pesach are allowed to do so, and those who don't are not allowed to do so, which seems to imply that it's perfectly permissible if you have the minhag to do so. And the answer is, if you look at the sugya in the Bavli, which I haven't produced for time purposes, but the Bavli seems clearly to have understood this Mishnah as meaning that everyone accepts that you're not allowed to have an imitation Korban Pesach on the night of Pesach. However, if you want to alter that imitation Korban Pesach in some way, you want to roast all of it, you want to cook some of it, you want to boil some of it. Or if you don't want to roast you want to roast it whole, but you don't want to eat a lamb, you want to eat or a sheep, you know, you want to eat a calf or some other animal, so that you may do. And those who have the tradition to do it may do so. You can have you can have steak on Pesach if that's your tradition, and if you don't have the tradition, then it's aser. But everyone agrees that having a gedima kulas is totally aser. And therefore, it seems that those who follow the Bavli tradition, and now Haggadah follows the Bavli tradition, that asking a question about why on the night of Pesach we eat a gedima kulas would seem to have no place in the Manashana, and therefore it's omitted. Now, is there another way that we can possibly understand this Mishnah in Pesach? And I believe that this is the way that the Yerushalmi understands it. But is there another way that is there an alternative matter for understanding this Mishnah in Pesach in source number 3? That those who have the custom to eat roasted meat on Pesach can do so, and those who don't cannot. Is there another way of understanding it? It's possible, I think, that what the Mishnah simply means to say is that for those who have a custom, like Rabbi Gamliel, to eat a gedima kulas on the night of Pesach, you may do so. It's permissible. If you want to bring an imitation Korban Pesach, you can. If, however, your tradition follows the tradition of the Chachamim, then you may not. And this, I believe, this understanding of the Mishnah, whereby it was clear that those who have a tradition to bring an imitation Korban Pesach on the night of Pesach are allowed to do so, was not only possible, I in fact think it was probable, and it describes a very popular custom that Jews, both in Rome and more prominently in Eretz Yisrael, had on the night of Pesach. And just like to quote two or three sources that demonstrate that this was in fact the case. First of all, we have Josephus. This is source number 6. Josephus, in recounting the story of the Exodus, says in source number 6, hence, still now, in the Greek word that I've given you in parentheses, it's not vuv, it's Greek spelling, so it's nun. Nun, the valence, the semantic valence of the word nun in ancient Greek writing, sort of Koine Greek that Josephus writes, is now, as of this writing, or as I'm talking just now. So in other words, when I wrote the Antiquities, when I wrote this book, which was in 93 CE, 20 or so years after the Second Thessalonicus was already destroyed, in accordance with the custom, we sacrifice thus. We bring the carbon Pesach. We bring some sort of imitation carbon Pesach. And of course, Josephus, when he wrote the Antiquities, where was he living? Does anyone know? In Rome. He was living in Rome. So this corroborates beautifully the practice of that is recorded in the Tosefta of Theudas Ishromi, of Todos Ishromi, who instructed the Jews of Rome to bring a carbon Pesach, an imitation carbon Pesach, on the night of Pesach. So it was clearly the minhag of Rome. More importantly, there are other sources in rabbinic literature that record this practice of bringing an imitation carbon Pesach that was called the Pesach on the night of Pesach without any dissenting opinions and without criticizing it at all. And this is the source in source number 7. Source number 7 says the following. This relates to the laws of death and purity, but without getting bogged down in those complicated issues, essentially what happened is this. Ma'aseh beveis Dagon b'Yehuda, be'echad shemeis erev Pesachin. In the city of Beit Dagon, and for those of you who know where Beit Dagon is, please hold that thought. We'll explain it in a moment. The people who lived in Beit Dagon, so what happened? Someone died in Erev Pesach. Right? Someone died in Erev Pesach. V'hal kul kavro, so they wanted to bury him. They wanted to bury this person. So what happened? So the source goes on to say that the men who were bringing the carbon Pesach that night, bo bayom, were concerned that if they were to come in contact with either the mace or with the stone above the tomb, which also it's a machlokus about what it imparts, but it does impart some sort of impurity. They didn't want it to come into contact with anything related to the person who had passed away, and therefore they sent the women of their community who are not going to be involved in the Pesach for whatever reason. They sent them in to deal directly with the mace. And the men preserved their purity so that they could go and bring the carbon Pesach. And then the source concludes, V'asu pisrayem la'erev. So that evening, they went and brought their carbon Pesach. Now, this source must have taken place after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. How do I know? How do I know this? It's a fact. Where is Beit Dagon? So if you remember, I believe it's a kibbutz that they call Beit Dagon. It's relatively close to where the actual city is. You're right, there is. It's near Bnei Brak. It's far to the north. It's near ancient Bnei Brak. It's far to the north. Beit Dagon was initially a city. It's mentioned in Tanakh and under another name. It's mentioned in Tanakh. It was a city that was occupied by the Plishtim. Yes, because their god was Dagon, right? Dagon. So Beit Dagon eventually in the period of the rabbis has now been excavated. The Arabs preserved the name in the settlement that they erected on top of the site is essentially Beit Dagon. So they've preserved the site, and it's been positively identified with really beyond any shadow of a doubt as Beit Dagon. Beit Dagon was so far from Yerushalayim, there's no possible way, forget within a day, there's no possible way within several days that anyone could possibly have made it from Beit Dagon to Yerushalayim to eat the Karban Pesach and slaughter the Karban Pesach in the proper place. Even if you started right in the morning and got there all late and got there just before the second before you could slaughter the carbon Pesach, it was not possible. And therefore, I believe it's quite simple to understand this Tosefta as referring to a practice that the Bnei Eretz Israel had to slaughter a Gedima Kulas, an imitation carbon Pesach, on the night of Pesach. And as the Tosefta told us in source number 5, they would call it a Pesach, right? V'asu pisrayem la'erev. They would have a Pesach at night, an imitation carbon Pesach. And finally, this is just for kicks. Source number 8. So source number 8 is a source from Jerome, the Church Father, from the 5th century BCE. Now, this is not a theological doctrinal text. CE. Oh, sorry, I put BCE. Right. No, that would predate the beginning of Christianity by a good 4 centuries. By CE. Sorry, my mistake. So Jerome, this is not a doctrinal theological text. This is really just practical rabbinics. Jerome was corresponding with Augustine, a North African, the famous North African church father, and they were discussing the issue of whether or not there's a chiyuv me'ikra din to criticize Jews for keeping mitzvos, for shmiras ha-mitzvos. So the chiyuv me'ikra din, is it a reshus? Is it, you know, permissible but not obligatory? Or is it a chiyuv? Is it a mitzvah? Is it obligatory? So Augustine thought that there was no chiyuv me'eger adin to criticize Jews, no obligation, truly, to criticize Jews for observing mitzvahs. But Jerome was much more chareid. Jerome thought that there was an absolute obligation to do so. How does he know? So he says, essentially to Augustine, he says, you're a bishop, right? And you get converts from Judaism all the time. This was unfortunately, tragically prevalent in the 5th century BCE, when Christianity, with the imprimatur of the Roman Empire, was on the rise. So he says, if you would prove what you assert, receive any Jew who, after becoming a Christian, so in other words, if someone is converted to Christianity from Judaism, so what if they do all of the things that he's about to say? He circumcises any son that may be born to him, he observes the Jewish Sabbath, and on the evening of the 14th day of the first month, slays a Paschal lamb. And when you've done this, or rather you've refused to do it, because I know that you're a Christian, you'd never be over on such a chomer din. So, since you won't do that, it must be that you believe that there is an obligation to criticize Jews for being observant. Now, why is this source important? This source is important because here in the 5th century BCE, Jerome is telling his compatriot in North Africa that what is it common for Jews, and Jerome at this point was living in Israel, what was it common for Jews of this period to do? Mundane things. Things that every Jew would do. Give your son a bris milah, you would observe Shabbos, and on Pesach, on the 14th day of Pesach, you would slaughter a Pesach. You would slaughter a carbon Pesach, an imitation carbon Pesach. So this, I believe, is yet another witness to the prevalence of this minhag. And then finally, in the Eretz Yisrael Haggadah, aside from the fact that they retain the question about why on other nights do we eat roasted, meat prepared all sorts of ways, and yet tonight we eat roasted meat. So beyond that, at the end of the Haggadah, at the end of Nagid, when we make the brachos on the food that we're about to eat, so what is the bracha that the Eretz Yisrael Haggadahs preserve, in contradistinction to the ones that our Haggadah preserves, in source number 9? And I've given you all the manuscripts, in case you're inclined to look it up, I've given you all the manuscript numbers. Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, Asher Tzivo Lechol Matzah Merorim, we're eating matzah, we're eating maror, and Basar Tzliyesh, and we're eating, essentially, a Gedima Kulas. In other words, it's very clear to me that there was a practice for those who followed the rite, the Haggadah rite of Eretz Yisrael, that they would eat an imitation carbon Pesach on Pesach night. Now, halacha psuka, and this is accepted by every single halachic decisor amongst the major poskim, beginning with the tour, the text I've given you in source number 10, is that you can eat, if you have the custom to do so, you can eat whatever roasted meat you want. And if you don't have the custom to do so, then you can't. The one thing that everyone agrees upon is that a gedima kulas is asur b'chol makom. No one may ever eat a gedima kulas. So for those of us, and which is essentially everyone in Klal Yisrael, who accepts the authority of the Bavli, the halakha psuka, the clear decision that has been rendered for us by the giants of the halakhic tradition, is that we may never have been allowed to eat a gedima kulas, an imitation carbon Pesach, on Pesach night. However, I think it's interesting, just as a matter of this, I'll conclude, I think it's interesting to investigate the origin or the reasons why these customs, at least for several centuries, diverged. Why do we have these two traditions? On the one hand, to eat a gedima kulas, to eat an imitation carbon Pesach, and on the other, to absolutely refrain from it. So much so that commenting on this source in the Torah, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef, writes that it's actually a laudable custom for a person to eat lamb meat that has been, or regular meat that has been cooked, not roasted, on Pesach night. Why? Because it shows specifically that you don't accept the opinion that allows a person to eat an imitation carbon Pesach on the night that requires roasting. Okay, so why do we have these two traditions? I'd argue, and this I'll finish, is that it's important to understand how Pesach was experienced for nearly 1,500 years, a millennium and a half, 1,300 years, nearly a millennium and a half prior to the destruction of the temple. Prior to the destruction of the temple, every single source, without any exception, in Chumash, in Nach, all Second Temple sources, and those in Chazal that relate to the Temple period, every single source waxes poetic, goes on at length about the glory, the joy, the celebration that accompanied bringing the Korban Pesach, that accompanied the sacrificial rite in Yerushalayim when pilgrims would come from across Israel, and in some cases from across the diaspora, to Yerushalayim to bring the Korban Pesach. Oh, what a joyous occasion. nary a mention in almost every single source, and really no time is spent whatsoever, proportionally speaking, on discussing any other aspect of Pesach, including the Haggadah, which for us dominates the night. All the focus is on bringing the Karban, on bringing in sacrifice. So now here you are. It's 70 CE. Our temple has been destroyed because of the cruelty of our Roman overlords. The most precious thing about Pesach has been ripped away from us. Brutally. So what's left? What do we do? What do we do now that we don't have a Beis HaMikdash? Now that we can't bring the Karban Pesach? So I submit to you that there were essentially two approaches. And you can conceptually imagine both of them. Approach number one is essentially to say, for whatever reason, we can't possibly presume to judge the Almighty. Our temple has been ripped away from us and been destroyed. We can no longer bring the Karban Pesach the way it's meant to be brought. And this tears at our soul. It brings us to tears. So much so that we pine. We pine for the opportunity to bring the Karban Pesach. And we'll do anything that we can to recreate even a shadow of the simcha, of the joy that we had when we brought the Karban Pesach. We'll do anything. Even if it means bringing an imitation Karban Pesach, something that's a fraction of a fraction of what would have been desirable, we're willing to do that. This seems to have been the approach of Rabban Gamliel and the Jews of Eretz Yisrael. Most likely they felt the loss of the temple most keenly. But then there's the Chachamim of the Mishnah, and the Chachamim of the Bahri, who took an approach that was not in the spirit of Ay Nehayalanu, oh, what have we lost? How we wish we could go back to those days when we had the Karban Pesach. The Chachamim of the Bavli had a much more forward-looking, optimistic, positive approach. They said, if you eat an imitation Karban Pesach, you are running the risk of what? Of teaching people, of showing people, that it's potentially okay to eat the Karban Pesach b'chutz, outside of Yerushalayim, and violate an Isser. It's okay! Now, the temple is no longer standing, so certainly this doesn't apply right now. Bo Bayom. If you go to someone's house on Pesach and you saw them eating lamb chops, the last thing you would think is that, oh, this must be, they must be trying to teach me that it's okay to eat kutch and bachutz. You would never think that. You'd just say, what an interesting menu on Pesach. I've never had this before. The Chachamim of the Bavli, however, were so forward-looking, so optimistic about the fate of the Jewish people, that they said, the temple could be rebuilt tomorrow. And of all the things that can be done in the temple, the easiest thing to do is to shech the Karban Pesach. In fact, there are those later authorities, there are contemporary authorities, Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, Rabbi Rashi of Ramat Gan, believes that even Bizman HaZeh, we should all be bringing in Karban Pesach. Now, for a variety of technical and maybe practical reasons, this is undesirable. But nonetheless, if we expect a redemption to come immediately, if we're optimistic about our hopes and dreams as Jewish people, it's crucial that we not give the impression that a person should conduct himself within the context of the sacrificial order in a way that would be osur, that is osur, when the temple is standing. By omitting the component of the Manishtana that talks about the Gedima Kulos, roasting the Karban Pesach, an imitation Karban Pesach, on the night of Pesach, we are essentially saying, we, the followers of the Babylonian Nusach HaGadah, that we expect our redemption to occur post-haste. We expect it to occur immediately. And I believe that's the lesson that we learn of the Gedima Kulas from the third question of the Manishtana that we find in the Mishnah. That'll conclude.
The hour is late, which means the pressure is on. So we will do our best to be as brief as possible. I'm happy to discuss more after we conclude for the evening. I was in my office selling chametz a little while ago, and someone came in, and they said, Rabbi Zirkin, I hope I'm not interrupting. What are you up to? So I said, actually, I still don't know exactly what I'm going to say tonight at the clergy parole. So he said to me, he said, Rabbi, just talk about the new pope. The new pope. So I said to him, I said, Mark, come on, I got to save something for Shabbos. So it occurred to me in the elevator on the way down that there are four rabbis participating tonight, and there are, of course, four sons at the Seder, Chacham, Rasha, to Tom, and the She'ini Yodei Lishol. And speaking last, it occurs to me that the She'ini Yodei Lishol, all it means is that by the time it's his turn, there's really not much left to say. Which just means that one of the previous speakers was the Rasha of the night. It's probably the one who stole my Dvar Torah. Okay, so I want to ask really very quickly one question. I don't want to offer the greatest of answers, but just something to think about as we explore Pesach as we prepare for the Seder. The question is as follows. What is the nature of the celebration of freedom at the Seder? And more specifically, is the mitzvah to celebrate Chayrus, to celebrate Jewish freedom, an eternal mitzvah that can never be taken away from us? What would you say to the Jew today that is stuck in prison? What would you say to the Jew who was living in the desert and he had the chutzpah to say, I would rather be in Mitzrayim eating watermelon than stuck out here with mun and water? So then he's supposed to sit at the Pesach Seder and say, thank God I'm free? He's not free. He wishes he wasn't free. And in a more serious note, what would you say to someone, excuse me, what would you say to someone who suffered, someone who was living 70 years ago, and their life was not as privileged as ours was? And they said, under their breath, at the Seder, this is what we celebrate. This is what we celebrate. Reb Zalman Sarutzkin has a magnificent Haggadah. It is, it's by far my favorite. And he points out that we say in davening every single day, Hamotzi Esamo Yisrael Mitocham, he who took out the Jewish people, Mitocham, from within them, L'Chayrus Olam, to eternal freedom. Is it true that we celebrate eternal freedom? Can that freedom never be taken from us? Or is the freedom subjective? Is it dependent on circumstance? Can it wax and it wane, like the story of Jewish history? So of course, in the theme, the spirit of the Seder, we'll answer this question with at least two or three more. Why is it that the Torah emphasizes more than once that the Jewish people were taken out of Mitzrayim in the spring? Has anybody asked that question yet tonight? Because I came late. Hopefully not. Ki b'chodesh aviv hotziacha Hashem mimitzrayim laila. Ki b'chodesh aviv hotzi Hashem eschem. One after the next. The Torah tells us, you left Mitzrayim and you left in the spring. The implication is, if the weather was not so great, the Jewish people would have said, forget this, I didn't bring my coat. That's the implication of the psukim, right? At least we went out in the spring. So what exactly does that mean to convey? The second question I would pose is one that we discussed last night in our Gemara Shir, and I've been thinking about it ever since. The Gemara in Arvei Pesachim on Kuf Tes Zayin on the days makes the most bizarre hekesh you could imagine. Rav Acha bar Yaakov in the Gemara there says that a person who is blind is not obligated in celebrating the Seder. He doesn't have a mitzvah to say the Haggadah. Where does he get that from? Where does he get that from? So the Gemara says it's a hekesh, it's a gzir shava. From who else? The Ben Sora or Mora. No, you can't call out, that's cheating. Ben Sora or Mora. Ben Sora or Mora. The wicked son. The son who abandons the traditions of his parents. He steals wine, he's an underage drinker, and he's put to death. The parents turn to the court and they say, we don't have anything left to do. We throw our hands in the air. Bineinu zeh soreru moreh. This is him. That's it. What can we do? The same thing we say at the Seder. We say that God took us out bizeh, at this night, at this time, in this place. Says the Gemara, just as the halacha dictates that a ben soreru moreh, whose parents are blind, cannot be put to death, so too someone who is blind is excused from reciting the Haggadah. There is an interesting machlokas in the Gemara, whether someone who is blind is obligated in any mitzvot at all. He has no vision, maybe he shouldn't be expected to do anything. That's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says he doesn't have the same principles when it comes to monetary laws. He doesn't have the same guidelines if he's victimized for his disability as other people, and he doesn't have the same rules when it comes to mitzvos. The Gemara rejects that opinion. The Beis Yosef says it very clearly. That's not the halacha. Someone who has trouble with his vision is still obligated to fulfill the mitzvos as every other Jew. I mentioned the Gemara says a story about Rav Yosef, who himself was blind, that he first said, I'm blind, and if someone tells me that Rav Yehuda is correct, and I'm not obligated in mitzvos, I'm going to make a kiddush for the whole shul.
Why? Because he says, if I'm not obligated in mitzvot, and I do them anyway, I'm a bigger tzaddik than everybody else here. So that's how we paskin, kiddush is on me. It's the language of the Gemara. You make a yom ha'tavol rabbana. And then the Gemara tells him, by the way, they responded, unfortunately, gadol ha'metzuvah ha'osa m'nishayin ha'metzuvah ha'osa, better to be obligated in mitzvot than to do them voluntarily. So he said to them, anybody who tells me that Rabbi Yehuda is wrong, the kiddush is on me. And that's probably what happened. So that is not the case. Person who is who's blind, person who has no vision, is obligated to fulfill mitzvot, to daven, to put on tefillin, to keep kosher, the works. But according to Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, he is still excused from having to celebrate the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Meshech Achmav gives an answer that is, I think, historically slightly outdated and a little bit problematic, but it sheds light on our initial question. The Iver, says the Meshech Achmav, suffers from the same challenge as the child of someone who is blind, the Ben Sora Ramona. He says that there is a lack of connection between the parents who suffer, who cannot see their child, and the Ben Sora Ramona who goes off the derech. They have a harder time maintaining a deep connection with the son that they can't see. And therefore, it's not so surprising. It's unlikely. It's extremely unlikely. It probably never happened in the Gemara's tradition. But if this child were to abandon the ways of his parents, to a certain extent, we would understand that. And he would be totally off the hook for his action. The same thing he says is true, and that's the meaning of this Gezeira Shavah, same thing is true for someone who cannot visualize what's going on at the Seder. Can you imagine, he says, coming out of Yetzias Mitzrayim and not visualizing Kriyas Yamsuf? Could you imagine coming out of Yetzias Mitzrayim and not being there to witness the Kol Subrakim and Har Sinai, unless you assume like the Medrash that he would feel? A difficult experience. And he says Meshech Chachma, he suggests himself, how difficult was it for this person, before there was Braille, before there were other opportunities, how difficult would it be for him to celebrate his freedom? In Mitzrayim, he probably could not do that much, and in the desert, he couldn't do that much either. He couldn't express his full interest in freedom, because what could he do? Nowadays, the world is different, but back then, he was limited. So limited that he couldn't celebrate his freedom. And Rav Acha Bar Yaakov suggests that if he is not capable of celebrating his freedom, it would be unspeakable to expect him to celebrate it with everyone else. And you could extrapolate from Rav Acha Bar Yaakov even further. If your life doesn't pan out like everyone else's, if you're suffering, if you are underprivileged, and everyone else is just so fortunate and so happy on Pesach night, and you're miserable, how can you ask somebody to say, Shevach v'hodah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How can they possibly thank God for the difficult circumstances that they can't overcome? That's the suggestion of the Meshech Achmav. Now, that assumes one thing. Well, it obviously assumes that the blind really do suffer, do lack a certain element of happiness, which of course is a very debatable assumption. But the reason I mention it is because it also assumes that the celebration of Cheiros on Pesach is an objective one. It's universal. And therefore, I shouldn't say it's universal, it's objective. It's happiness. It's happiness that we can quantify. And if someone doesn't have the ability to appreciate that happiness, they're completely excused. Rav Zalman Sarutzkin takes the exact opposite approach to the Cheiros of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And in fact, we know that the Gemara darshins from Charos al Haluchos that the letters of the Ten Commandments were etched into the tablets. Charos and Cheiros sound very similar. He says it's permanent. The Cheiros will never go away, just like the engraving on those tablets can never be undone. But how is that so? How does the Cheiros perpetuate itself from one season to the next? And he says that's really what the symbolism of the spring is all about, Chodesh Aviv. He says when springtime comes, you think it's like beginning to blossom, and you forget all of those people who did all the hard work in the winter to plant and prepare for everything to come out. It's really the hard work that precedes, that leads us to celebrate the Chodesh Aviv. It gives us the privilege and the right to reap the benefits of our hard labor. So he says, it's not surprising that the Torah says, Ki b'chodesh aviv utiyacha Hashemi Mitzrayim laila, that God took you out in the spring, but he took you out at night. He took you out when it was dark. He took you out when you didn't have as much hope as you wish you could have possibly had. That's when God took us out. Even when it's Lila, even when there's still hope yet to come, and right now we're not where we want to be, says Rezalman Tzoretzkin, our obligation to Kairos is still ongoing. For those who've read the psychological perspective of Viktor Frankl, they know very well that Viktor Frankl's experience in the Holocaust shaped the way that he understood human suffering. And there's nothing more profound that can be said by a victim of the Holocaust, and probably by no one else, than to say our experience is not determined by what goes on around us, but determined by how we react to the way we're treated. And that was the bottom line message that Viktor Frankl tried to convey. I am not upset. I am not imprisoned. I am not tortured if that's not the way that I react to my experience. If this is my challenge, if this is my opportunity, if this is my moment, it's mine. No one can ever take my reaction away from me. And that's exactly what Sorotkin says Kairos is all about. It's not about living the life of luxury. It's not about the world where David Brooks pens an article about the beauty of pomegranate. That's not what it's about. It's about understanding that we have a mission that is eternal, a mission that gives us the skills and it gives us the ability to respond to any circumstance in a religious way. And that ability to respond, that's what we mean when we say, Hamotzi Samu Yisrael Mitocham L'Kairos Olam. It challenges us in many ways. It reminds us that there are those out there that are less privileged than we are, but they are not told not to celebrate the Pesach Seder. They are told to celebrate the Pesach Seder, but it's our responsibility to allow them to experience it. It means going the extra mile to make sure that when you lift up the matzah and the maror, there are people out there who can't see the difference. That when you put things on the table to get your kids to ask the questions, there are people who can't see that kind of trick being played. There are people out there who can't participate when it comes time to hide the afikomen. But they too are obligated in Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim. We have a very unique opportunity to understand that there is both an objective definition of simcha, or what people might call freedom today, but there's also the message the Torah sends about Kairos, that we can respond to any situation. We can respond when we are suffering, we can respond when we are underprivileged, and we also have the opportunity to help those that need to respond to a better, more challenging situation than most of us face. As we conclude for the night and we move forward, to celebrate Pesach, it's really important to take the time to think about those that are not as privileged as we are, those of us who sit in the room tonight. People who don't have a place to go yet for Seder, and it's only 1 week away. People who don't have the money to buy the food that they need to make a normal Seder for their family. Or people who have disabilities that prevent them from doing the Seder normally, which requires that we think more creatively. Whether that be educationally, like Rabbi Friedman mentioned, that they're not yet inspired to fulfill the mitzvah and its ideal sins. Excuse me, we have to create a Seder that will inspire them. Whether physically or psychologically, they don't have the ability to sit at the table and participate like everyone else, it's our unique privilege to maximize the lessons of Kairos, to respond well, and to make sure that everyone has a Chag Kasher Sameach. Wonderful evening.